From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with jazz critic Gary Giddens about his new biography of Charlie Parker and his American Jazz Orchestra, which interprets classic jazz compositions. Also today, I speak with novelist Mary Gordon, author of The Company of Women, Final Payments, and a collection of short stories titled Temporary Shelter. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward examines the career of soul singer Percy Sledge. Ed says there's more to Sledge's music than his one big hit, When a Man Loves a Woman. And book critic John Leonard reviews Rachel and Her Children, Jonathan Kozol's examination of homeless families in New York City. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Gary Giddens, one of America's foremost jazz critics. He's written for the Village Voice since 1973. In his writing, he's bemoaned the fact that big band music has been in large measure shunted to university campuses and student orchestras. He said that we need a big band music that keeps its eye on the future while celebrating its past. Now, instead of just writing about that need, Giddens is trying to fill it. He's co-founded the American Jazz Orchestra and serves as its artistic director. The orchestra interprets classic jazz compositions and commissions new works. This Thursday, the orchestra will perform compositions by Duke Ellington in a concert at Cooper Union in Manhattan. But more about that in a little while. In Giddens' first book, he wrote that there were three themes asserted repeatedly in the lives of jazz musicians who came of age in the 1930s and 40s. The impact of Charlie Parker, the devastating post-war presence of heroin, and the difficulties of surviving without compromising one's music. He zeroes in on those themes in his biography of Charlie Parker titled Celebrating Bird. It's just been published in paperback. This is Charlie Parker's 1945 recording of Coco, which Giddens describes as thrilling. Gary Giddens, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, for our listeners who aren't familiar with Charlie Parker's music, to explain his musical importance.
Charlie Parker is one of those comet-like figures who come, it seems, exactly at the crisis point or midlife crisis point in an art when it needs really profoundly new ideas and directions. And Parker provided them. Jazz in the early and middle 1940s was coming down from the big band high. During the war, the big band era really kind of died and was replaced by singers and pop-type bands. And the solo styles of the 20s and 30s, just about everything you could play on them, had been done. And along comes Charlie Parker, an autodidactic, virtuoso musician from Kansas City, and a few other colleagues who are thinking the way he thinks. And he revises the whole-scale notions of harmony, rhythm, and consequently the melodies that you make out of those harmonies and rhythms. And so he gave jazz a whole new life. And really, for the last 40 years, notwithstanding all the other revolutions that have come along, like the so-called new thing and the avant-garde, really the last 45 years have been pretty much jazz has been a music that proceeds from Charlie Parker as much as all of the jazz before him proceeds from Louis Armstrong.
Within the world of jazz, he's a figure who's been much written about. Is it a difficult task to write about someone who's been so thoroughly discussed and researched?
Not at all. I regret to say that so many of the musicians... Well, let me begin by saying that although the jazz literature comprises a great many extraordinary books in many fields, there are certain areas that jazz literature is sorely lacking in, and I think most particularly biography. I don't know of one jazz biography that you'd seriously compare with the great literary biographies or biographies of artists in other areas. And frequently the scholarship is quite shoddy. And the thing that shocked me when I started researching Parker is that when I went back to the previous books, there were errors on every page, but basic errors, dates, names, places, Charlie Parker being written about in cities that he couldn't possibly have been in. And then the keystone of my research was interviews with his first wife, a woman who knew Parker from the time he was 15, earlier actually, from the time he was a boy, and who married him when they were both, I think, 16 or 17. And she had never been interviewed by any Parker biographer, so she gave me a whole new insight into the Kansas City period and his growing up.
Yeah, what do you think are some of the new insights that she gave you into Parker's life?
Let's see. I guess one logical place to begin with is the narcotics. Parker used to like to boast that he was taking heroin from the time he was 12. Rebecca points out that was impossible. And she tends, although this is somewhat based on her circumstantial observations, she seems to think that Parker's serious encounters with drugs were direct. There's a direct correlation between them and this accident that he had. He was involved in a car accident in 1937, I believe it was, when he broke several ribs and another musician in the car was killed, and another one was hospitalized for several weeks. And Parker recuperated for a period of 2 months upstairs, and his home was in tremendous pain. And about that time, she remembers him, strangers traipsing up the stairs with pills and drugs and the other thing. She also points out numerous little incidents and facts simply were not part of Parker lore before. For example, the fact that Duke Ellington invited him to join the band in 1939, and he refused and instead went with Jay McShann. Talking to various musicians who knew Parker back in that period, you begin to learn how assiduously he studied. From a musical point of view, the thing that fascinated me that has never appeared in any commentary, critical or biographical, about Parker, and is now becoming cliche since the book came out a year ago, is the fact that one of his major influences was Chew Berry. Now, when I grew up reading about Parker, and in every book, they always talk about Lester Young and Buster Smith, and Lester Young and Lester Young, and how he memorized all the solos, and that's where he comes from. And in fact, he was just as influenced by the so-called the Coleman Hawkins Rococo virtuoso style of saxophone playing. And Rebecca says that the great breakthrough for him in his music was when Fletcher Henderson's 1936 recording of Stealin' Apples came out, which has a chorus-long solo by Chew Berry. She said he played that record religiously, repeatedly, memorized the solo, played it on saxophone and piano. So here you have a whole new lineage added to the development of Parker's music.
Jazz critic Gary Giddens is my guest, and he's the author of a book called Celebrating Bird and the associate producer of a film also called Celebrating Bird that includes a lot of documentary footage of Parker performances. Gary Giddens is also the artistic director of the American Jazz Orchestra, a subject we'll discuss a little bit later. You know, in writing about someone like Parker, you're going to meet dozens and dozens of people who tell you, like, the pivotal story in their life about how Parker affected them or what Parker said to them. There's so many probably apocryphal stories that circulate about Parker. Were there any stories that you particularly wanted to research and see if they were really true or not?
Oh, yes. you hit a kind of a sore point because I was held up in a tremendous snafu for several months in an attempt to research Parker's death, and I won't go into detail, but I interviewed numerous people, spoke to lawyers, made many attempts to look at the death certificate and various other records which are kept private, most of which I could never get my hands on. And there's no question in my mind that there is still some mystery about about his death, when it took place, all of the contributing factors. I don't know what the answer to that mystery is. All I know is that there are many, many rumors, all of which contradict each other. And I don't know that anyone will ever know the truth because there were only two witnesses and they ain't talking. But for your listeners who don't have no idea what I'm talking about, let me just say briefly that Parker died and nobody knew about it for 2 or 3 days. He died in the home of Baroness Koningswater, who was living at the Stanhope Hotel. And there was a rumor going around the city, on New York City, on that weekend that Parker had died. Murray Kempton and Bill Dufty, who were reporters at the New York Post at that time, called on a hunch the Bellevue, the morgue, and they were told no, there was no Charlie Parker, there was only a John Parker, and a black male, dead, listed at 53 years of age. And it turns out that for some reason Parker had been delivered there under that name. And later the Baroness said that she had not told anybody about the fact that Parker had died because she didn't want the widow, Chan, to learn about it in the paper. She wanted to contact her first. But as I say, I can't even get into the specifics of the rumors because they might be slandering. They would be perhaps slandering people. But there are stories that people have saw Parker around that day, the day that he supposedly died. The fact that the body was in the apartment for some 3 or 4 hours before it was, between the time when it was declared dead by the medical examiner and when it arrived at Bellevue, and those hours had never been, I think, explained. And there are other factors here. So it's. It's a mystery. Parker was only 34 years old when he died, and yet the medical examiner estimated him as being a black male in his late 50s or early 60s.
And that was largely because of the ravages of heroin.
Indeed, and of alcohol.
You know, something that's really interesting is that Parker recorded some wonderful sessions with strings. Now, the kind of string arrangements that back him up are really kitschy stuff. I mean, you'd think that someone with his jazz brilliance would resist strings, but you talk about how he loved it and how he felt that he was really given his due when he was playing with strings.
Well, yes and no. I also talk about the fact that he did want to work with George Russell, for example. He commissioned George Russell to write the theme for strings, and had he lived and had he had more, had he been more in control, and you know, I mean, psychically as well as everything else, I think that there would have been, you would have seen him recording with arrangements by people like George Russell. Gil Evans he did use on one session with Singers, but he never had him write for the string ensemble. The fact is that it was an expensive and experimental thing to put together a string ensemble. Norman Granz financed it and brought in two California hack arrangements who had been writing for the big bands. And they wrote those, as you say, kitschy arrangements. Some of them are quite terrible. But then you see that, for example, Easy to Love, Parker on his own commissioned Jimmy Mundy to write a wonderful arrangement of that, which he later recorded and performed almost exclusively live. Jerry Mulligan write a few very good arrangements for the strings as well.
I want to play a minute of the Parker and Strings recording of Just Friends. What do you think of this recording?
Just Friends is unquestionably the best of the Strings records, not because the arrangement is so wonderful, but because Parker's solo is superb.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
All right.
Charlie Parker and Strings, Just Friends, as recorded in 1949. My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. Gary, Parker was really a very self-destructive personality and used a lot of heroin, and a lot of musicians in emulating Parker's music started shooting up as well. Any insights you'd like to offer about how he became such a self-destructive figure, or you know why he was so self-destructive? It's a theme in a way that runs through the arts and certainly runs through part of jazz.
Yes, it's difficult to know. I think one thing that we have to say at the outset is that when Parker started using drugs in the 1930s, there was none of the awareness about drugs that we have now. Let's begin by noting that marijuana, for example, was legal in the United States until 1936. So growing up in an environment where marijuana was readily available was not a lot more dramatic than kids who grow up today drinking beer. It was there. It was legal. It grew near the railroad tracks outside of town. And heroin, It was Parker's generation of musicians, and not just musicians, but people in every walk of life, who discovered just how deadly a drug heroin was. Some of them who got hooked didn't quite believe that they could get hooked or that they wouldn't be able to free themselves. And because Parker was such a charismatic figure, so dramatically original in every way, and had such an extraordinary personality, everybody I interviewed virtually said that they couldn't believe that he was only 25 or 26 when they met him. He always seemed like everyone's father, like everyone's guide and leader. So naturally, many of these younger musicians thought that, well, maybe the heroine is in some way tied up with his genius. When in fact, as Parker noted repeatedly in interview after interview and in private conversations with, again, virtually every musician I spoke with, he denied that vehemently. He said that anyone who says that you play better high is just a plain, straight-out liar. And in fact, many of Parker's greatest records were made in the year that he cut himself loose from heroin, 1947.
Gary, one last question about Parker. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that Clint Eastwood is directing a movie about Charlie Parker. Have you heard anything about it? What are your expectations of this movie?
Well, interesting you should ask that, because I'm will soon be on my way out to interview him.
To interview Eastwood?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I was pleased to learn that he had seen my film and liked it.
Really?
He apparently, from what I'm told, has a very serious love for Parker and the music. You know, Eastwood is a very cagey and clever filmmaker. He's every once in a while he does a film strictly for himself that he knows isn't going to make money. Honky Tonk Man was a picture he did about country music a few years ago. And he finances them by returning to his hole card, which is the Dirty Harry series. Apparently he told Warners that if they let him do this, he would give them another Dirty Harry, which he is now filming in San Francisco and which will actually come out 2 or 3 months before the Parker film. From what I've heard from various people who've seen the script, they say it's a very romantic Hollywoodization in which Parker is depicted primarily in his involvement only with Chan, as though this were the one woman in his life. And Red Rodney is a major character, and Dizzy Gillespie is not there. So what I'm saying is that it appears to be that this is a lot of the usual Hollywood liberties are taken. On the other hand, I'm also told that Eastwood managed to evoke the era quite well. And so I'm going with an open mind. I'm hoping it'll be wonderful. I'm hoping it'll at the very least spread the word about Parker, and that more people will know about him. This is a monumental figure in our music, and most people have never even heard the name, let alone the music. So I can only be at this point optimistic about this film.
My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. He writes for The Village Voice, is the author of several books, including his latest, which is called Celebrating Bird, a biography of Charlie Parker. And he's also done a home video on Charlie Parker that's also a biography with a lot of footage from the period. In a moment, we're going to talk about Gary Giddens' new project, which is the American Jazz Orchestra, a repertory jazz orchestra, and we'll be hearing some of their music, talking about their work after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Jazz critic Gary Giddens is my guest, and this week, March 3rd, his American Jazz Orchestra will be performing at Cooper Union in New York City. Gary, you put together this American Jazz Orchestra. You're the artistic director of it. What's your vision of the band?
Very simply, the original idea was to create a parallel to the Philharmonic Orchestras, which are in every cultural center of the United States, that play the 19th century European repertoire. Jazz is almost 100 years old. There's about 60 years body of work of music written for this uniquely American ensemble of 18 pieces consisting of reeds, brasses, and rhythm. And the music needs orchestras to play it, to keep it alive. This music was not conceived of for records. The recorded performances that we venerate are, except in very rare cases, not definitive performances. They're rather arbitrary performances done within the limitations of a 3-minute 78. And we believe that the music has its own validity in the scores, not just in the record. We don't begin with a record and we don't try to recreate or imitate the record. We go back to the score, to the written arrangements of people like Fletcher Henderson and Eddie Sauter and Gil Evans and Duke Ellington and Jimmy Mundy and Ralph Burns and many, many others, and we want to bring them alive. We think that this music is great and that people should hear it. Most people have never heard it in a concert hall, and it's a completely different experience.
Well, you make a very compelling point in one of your books. You say that imagine what it would be like if classical music were only performed by chamber ensembles and if there were no orchestras anymore. That's what
right.
it's like in jazz now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of the American Jazz Orchestra recording of Benny Carter compositions. And this is recorded. Was this recorded in concert?
No, this was
recorded
was done
in the studio.
The next
right,
day.
Right.
The very next day.
Okay, well, we're going to hear part of Carter's composition, Symphony and Riffs. Tell me briefly why you wanted to have a new recording and a new performance of this piece.
So many reasons. First of all, as Carter pointed out, a lot of the early records were done with virtually no rehearsal in the studio. He wasn't satisfied with the original performances. They're done in lo-fi, according to the recording techniques of the 1930s. As John Lewis boasts frequently, very few band leaders in history have ever had a brass section that can rival the one that we've put together, because it's an all-star group. The best studio guys in New York come together four or five times a year to make this music. So it's a crack orchestra, and it's a chance to reinterpret the music and to show that Benny Carter as a soloist is as great at the age of 80 as he was at 30 when he put the alto saxophone on the map.
Okay, well, let's hear the opening of Symphony in Riffs. That's Symphony and Riffs from the new American Jazz Orchestra recording of Benny Carter compositions. My guest, jazz critic Gary Giddens, is the artistic director and founder of the American Jazz Orchestra. This is really a new role for you. You've been a jazz critic all of your adult life, but now you're actually working with musicians, collaborating with them on music. It's interesting to me because when you're a critic, you're really worrying about the final product, the performance itself. But when you're working with an orchestra, things like promptness, you know,
right.
someone's ability
right.
to show up on time enters
yeah.
into it. Do you find yourself having a totally different relationship with the music and the musicians now?
I don't know that my relationship. Yes, it's become, I would say, certainly more intimate. You know where the relationship has really changed? It's in my writing. I know so much now from the other side that I didn't know then.
What kinds of things?
the so many things that go into making a big band. Uh-huh. Most of us who write about this music are obsessed with soloists. We don't know what a lead player does. We don't know what goes into making a section work or balancing one section against another, or all the details that go into making an arrangement really exciting, or all the possibilities that a conductor has in interpreting that arrangement, and the way tempos, adjusting tempos, can completely change the meaning of a performance. And it's been an enormously exciting and educational experience to watch the rehearsals, to see the way the music comes into being, and really to have a much closer look at the arrangements and the way they're put together. One of the things, Terry, that I wanted to mention in relationship to this whole idea of jazz repertory in the orchestra is the idea of interpretation. A lot of people, when they write about it, they talk about recreating the old pieces, and that word irks me. We're not recreating anything any more than Zubin Mehta is recreating, you know, Beethoven when he plays his symphonies. In classical music, interpretation is so much a part of performance that they take for granted. One of the most controversial and exciting records that's come out this year is Bernstein's new version of the Tchaikovsky Pathétique, which is about 10 or 12 minutes longer than any other version ever done. It's so slow that the articulation of the various sections is changed, and the piece is really made to come alive in a new way. It's really a thrilling thing. If we take a classic performance that people know from records and we slow it up or fast it, make it a little faster, we have people saying, well, the tempo was too slow, or it wasn't that fast on the record. Well, that's not the point. The point is you have scores, and then you have interpreters, you have conductors. John Lewis is going to conduct it differently than Frank Foster or the late Thad Jones or Maurice Paris or anyone else. And that's what interpretation is about. And the dream that we had when we started this, I mean, this is a dream, is not that the American Jazz Orchestra would somehow change the way we hear the music, but that it would help to create repertory orchestras that would proliferate all over the country. And so that you'd have that interpretation would become a natural part of the experience of listening to this music.
Do you see your work with the American Jazz Orchestra as being in conflict with your work as a jazz critic or as an extension of it?
Both. There is a conflict. I tried to deny that for a while, thinking that somehow I had an objective thing about it, but I'm not objective at all. When I sit there on the night of a concert, I don't hear anything but wonderful sounds, and it's only a week later when I start when I start playing the tapes, because we always make reference tapes, that I hear all the clams and mistakes. I don't hear them that night. I really don't. And so, no, I'm not at all objective, and it's very difficult for me. You know, I've learned a lot. My own ideas about interpretation, which I've been writing about in The Voice since 1973, have been a lot more focused by this experience, and I'd like to write about it. And it's difficult because at this point, how can I write about what I've learned about interpretation from the AJO without being self-serving? So that's difficult. But because I have learned a lot more about the way the music is made, there's no question that it's expanded my ideas about music, and I've learned a lot more about what musicians do.
Well, Gary, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And my guest has been Gary Giddens. He's the jazz critic for the Village Voice and the author of several books about jazz, including his latest, Celebrating Bird, The Triumph of Charlie Parker, which has just been published in paperback by William Morrow. There's also a home video of the same name. Giddens is the founder and artistic director of the American Jazz Orchestra. They'll perform in New York on March 3rd in a concert of Ellington compositions, including a performance of Black, Brown, and Beige. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with military historian Clay Blair. He's just written a book about the role of the Korean War in U.S. military strategy. I hope you can join us. Here's more music from the American Jazz Orchestra's recording of music by Benny Carter.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, writer Mary Gordon wrestles with some of the moral issues she's made her characters confront. Gordon is the author of the acclaimed novels Final Payments and The Company of Women. Her latest book is a collection of short stories. Also, rock historian Ed Ward makes the case for Percy Sledge as one of the most overlooked soul singers of the 60s. He's best remembered for the hit When a Man Loves a Woman. And book critic John Leonard reviews Rachel and Her Children, Jonathan Kozol's profile of the homeless population of a New York City welfare hotel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. Secretary of State George Shultz met today in London with Jordan's King Hussein to discuss the U.S. peace proposal for the Middle East. The plan calls for self-rule in the occupied territories now and then Israeli-Arab talks on a more comprehensive peace plan. After the meeting, Hussein issued a statement saying Jordan rejects any interim or partial solution. The statement did not reject the U.S. plan, but said it needs some development. Shultz also met today with British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who said the American plan offers the best hope for the region. There are reports tonight that four Libyan pilots may have defected to Egypt together with their ultra-modern Soviet MiG-23 fighter jets. NPR's Jim Letterman reports.
The reports are still unconfirmed. Both Egyptian President Mubarak and Egyptian Defense Minister Abu Ghazaleh are in Sudan for an official visit. But if the reports are true, the defections could be a major coup for the West. The MiG-23 is one of the most advanced aircraft in the Soviet arsenal, and Western intelligence services have wanted to get a hold of the plane for years to examine its characteristics. According to the reports in Egypt, the four Libyan pilots landed their aircraft at airfields in Egypt's western desert. Last year, two other Libyan pilots defected to Egypt. One flew in an American Chinook helicopter, the other in an American-built Hercules transport. If the story of the Libyan pilots is true this time, and if Egypt does have the MiG-23s, it would give Cairo a considerable bargaining chip in its negotiations with the U.S. to reschedule Egypt's considerable and ever-mounting foreign debt. In Jerusalem, I'm Jim Letterman.
British and Irish authorities have confirmed the IRA is equipped with Soviet-made SAM-7 aircraft missiles, which they say were supplied by Libya. NPR's Vera Franco reports from London.
The possibility that the IRA might have got its hands on SAM-7 missiles was first raised in public last autumn, when French customs officers intercepted a massive consignment of weapons aboard an Irish crude ship off the Brittany coast. The haul included 20 SAM-7s, and several of the ship's crew were later identified as active members of the IRA. Now, in a programme broadcast by BBC TV, British and Irish authorities have confirmed that several earlier shipments of arms supplied by Libya did reach the IRA and that they included SAM-7s. The chief of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, Sir John Herman, said he had no reason to doubt that the IRA had the weapons hidden somewhere, while the Irish Justice Minister, Gerry Collins, said some of the SAM-7s might very well be in Northern Ireland already. For National Public Radio, I'm Vera Frankel in London.
Former TV evangelist Pat Robertson has decided to take the recommendation of his political advisers and drop his libel suit against former Congressman Pete McCloskey. The trial was scheduled to begin on Super Tuesday, March 8th, when primaries or caucuses will be held in 20 mostly southern states. The $35 million suit alleges that McCloskey lied in a widely publicized letter accusing the Republican presidential hopeful of using his father's influence to have him withdrawn from combat during World War II. McCloskey says he plans to go to court and will not agree to an out-of-court settlement that does not include reimbursement by Robertson for $400,000 in legal costs. The Commerce Department today reported its index of leading economic indicators fell 0.6% in January. The figure disappointed many experts who had predicted a smaller decline. Conference Board economist Della Smith.
I think it just shows that we're having a weakening economy, and I would like to emphasize that this does not indicate a recession.
The Commerce Department also issued revised figures for the December index, showing an increase rather than the decline originally reported. The revision is seen as good news. If the preliminary figures had held up, they would have marked the third consecutive monthly decline, which is often taken as a sign of a recession. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped a point to 2070.46. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If you were a teenager in the 60s, you probably danced, slow danced, to the songs of Percy Sledge. These days, you can hear a re-recording of Sledge singing When a Man Loves a Woman on a Subaru TV commercial. Sledge's popularity in the 60s lasted only about 14 months during 1966 and 67. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says Sledge packed that time with great moments.
I was in Louisiana recently and heard that Percy Sledge was living in Baton Rouge and was performing again, doing quite well at it. That was heartening news because I've always felt that Sledge is one of the most overlooked of the 60s soul singers, condemned to being a footnote in most histories as a one-hit wonder. That one hit, of course, was this. It was a song that came about by accident when Sledge, a hospital orderly who'd done some singing in high school, was called in to substitute for a friend in a band that had a show to do in a small club in Alabama. In the audience was a man from a local recording studio that was beginning to see some action. As Sledge told Peter Guralnick in his book Sweet Soul Music, "I was standing up on stage, I'd had a few scotches, so I guess my mind was a little blowed up, and all of a sudden I just hollered out, 'Why did you leave me, baby?' So Quinn Ivey just happened to be in the club that night, and he asked me if I'd come down to his studio. So we changed 'Why'd You Leave Me' to 'When a Man Loves a Woman,' and all the musicians say, everybody in the studio say, 'I believe we might have a smash.'" It was true. They did. And Atlantic Records, which had been watching Ivey's studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, picked the record up and made it a bestseller. But what I find unusual about Percy Sledge is that after that, many of the songs he recorded were very much like country tunes. Let me wrap you in my warm and tender love. Yeah. Let me wrap you in my warm and tender love. Warm and Tender Love, the follow-up to When a Man Loves a Woman, was one of those quintessentially Southern records that walks the borders of soul and country, blues and gospel, that you can imagine any performer doing, just as long as they're Southern. This was in part because Sledge hooked up with Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham, two great songwriters. Penn had been responsible for James Carr's magnificent Dark End of the Street, and the two found Percy Sledge to be the perfect vehicle for their songwriting. His third record, It Tears Me Up, was his first Penn and Oldham song, and it, too, was a hit. But for me, the song that is Percy Sledge's greatest moment, and probably Dan Penn and Spooner Oldham's too, is Out of Left Field. It may have been too structuralist to catch on, but it's one of the most perfect flowing melodies ever written.
When least expected, yeah. Fate stumbles in, yeah. Bring light to the darkness.
yeah. Oh, what a friend. I needed someone to call my home. Suddenly,
by the time this record came out in 1967, Percy Sledge had already seen the best of his career. Although he cut some great tunes in the years to come, only one, Take Time to Know Her, caught on at all. His greatest hits album can still be found, though, and it's very much worth hearing. The testament of the voice and soul of a man who was much more than a one-hit wonder.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. Here's Percy Sledge singing Take Time to Know Her.
I found a woman I felt I truly loved. She was everything I'd ever been dreaming of. But she was bad, I didn't know it. Her pretty smile never did show it. All I knew, what I could see, and I knew I wanted her for me. I took her home to my...
You're listening to Fresh Air. Writer Mary Gordon grew up Catholic and working class. Her first novel, Final Payments, published in 1978, set her on an exploration of religious and moral issues that came out of her upbringing, issues like duty, self-sacrifice, guilt, and forgiveness. She stayed with many of those themes in her subsequent novels, The Company of Women and Men and Angels, as well as in some of her short stories. She's working on a new novel about Irish immigrants in America, which is set in the type of old neighborhood she had to leave to become a writer. Mary Gordon's most recent work is a collection of short stories titled Temporary Shelter. Gordon is visiting Philadelphia this week as a writer in residence at Temple University. I asked her when she's writing how she decides what becomes a short story and what becomes a novel.
I feel much more licensed to make a short story out of something more personal, something more autobiographical. An event which has struck me will often become the load for a short story in a way that it won't with a novel. I almost feel like I have to have an idea for a novel.
In that respect, is a story a lot like poetry, which
yes.
you used to write?
Yes, much more like poetry. And of course, it's compression. The challenges of the compression are like the challenges of poetry.
Now, you started writing poems, right?
I did, yes. I actually didn't write prose till I was 25.
That's pretty old. You know, very few people stick it out that long with poetry.
Well, I was very afraid of all the words in prose. I thought what I liked about poetry was every word was potent. Every word was controllable. Was an important weight. And I thought, well, there are all those us and all those does, to say nothing of the semicolons and the paragraphs. And I was really frightened of what I perceived to be the uncontrollable nature of prose. So it really held me back.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you don't write the kind of sprawling novel that's become very popular now. Your novels really are distilled.
Yes. But compared to poetry, they're quite sprawling. But I'm interested in that distillation in poetry. When I write badly, when I feel critical of a passage that I've written, what I feel critical of is a kind of waste or looseness, or even a kind of easy charm that will bother me a lot. I really like every word that's possible to be weighty and potent and highly efficient.
How did you start writing fiction after writing poetry?
I found that my poetry was getting more and more narrative. And that the stories that I wanted to tell were spilling out of the form and required something larger, required more detail, more space.
Do you write poetry anymore?
I do sometimes. I've just written a poem recently, but it's more occasional verse. It tends to be a poem about something that's really affected me, again, rather than finding an image that would be I think most real poets are moved by images. And I tend to be moved more by events now to write poetry about.
I think in your writing, you're really moved by ideas a lot.
Yes.
And I think that one of the distinguishing traits of your writing is that they're really about the characters' interior lives as much as they are about any kind of, you know, plot or storyline. Is that important to you in fiction?
Yes, it's very important to me in fiction, although I love plotting novels. I admire people who can do these wonderful plots. And I often envy the writers of the 18th century who just could write very plotty things. And it just seems like it was probably more fun. You dash down a lot of events, and Moll Flanders went to Virginia and then she came back. And, you know, she had an illegitimate child. She got sent to jail. And you just kind of jog through it in a way that if you're doing an interior life, it's much slower. But I must say that the fiction that I love tends to have that sort of thickness of interior life.
In order to get that interior life, you really have to get into the way somebody thinks, and not just the events that they've spent their life doing, but how they perceive things,
yes,
what their big moral crises are. And in your book of short stories, you have to do that for, like, dozens of different characters. Is that a difficult thing when it carries over into real life, to be able to see things through other people's eyes a lot? I think it's the kind of thing that can make you wonderful at writing and then indecisive in real life, because you see all the different possibilities.
I think I would be a better person if I lived more like a writer of short stories. I actually wish that there were more of a spillover, because I think, you know, there's that French phrase, to comprendre et to pardonner. If you understand everything, you forgive everything. You forgive your characters everything, because you always understand why they're doing it. And too often in life, I am standing outside people and judging them. I'm a very judgmental person in real life. I'm much more merciful to my characters.
Well, do you see that as a big contradiction, or just as the difference between life and fiction?
I think it's the contradiction between my life and my fiction. I think there are very gifted human beings who live the way I write. And that is something that I adore. I love seeing people who can do that, who can be so porous in their understanding of other human beings, because that to me is the center of real morality. You're not doing it out of duty. You're doing it out of sensitivity, because you really understand what people need, and you're listening so intently that you are a presence for them and they are a presence for you.
A lot of your stories and novels have to do with family, relationships, marriage, in a way that those are very traditionally female subjects to write about. Why do you choose those so frequently as your subjects?
I don't think I choose them. I think they choose me. I wish that I spent a lot of time thinking about Acid Rain, but I don't. You know? it's what I think about during the day, and it seems to be the issue or the sets of issues that compel me. So it's not like I say, I think I will write about the family. It's that those are the thoughts that are going on in my head.
In some of your stories, marriage is a haven in a way. It's a secure place to be. You have loving people around you. You have your home, your family. But your characters who believe it knowing about the fragility of their own marriage, that no matter how deeply loved they are, and no matter how deeply they love, the person they love might die. They might get ill. I mean, there's all these things that could happen that would break this safe haven. That seems to be something, that kind of insecurity, something that's always on your characters' minds, I think, knowing that things are fragile.
Yes. I think that's one of my obsessions, contingency of life and the dangerousness of our position. Simply having a body places one in great danger, because the body is mortal and vulnerable.
On the occasion when something like that actually does happen, when something that you feared will go wrong does go wrong, do you ever almost feel the sense of relief?
Yes.
Like, I've been worrying this would happen, something's going to break, something terrible is going to happen, and then it happens, and, well, at least you don't have to worry about it anymore. It happened, and you know specifically what the terrible thing is going to be.
That's right. There's a kind of, somehow the sound of breaking glass can be a wonderful sound because it's so complete and final. And again, as you say, you don't have to worry about the shape and the limits of it. Yes, there is, at least in the middle of a disaster, you can relax. You don't have to be anxious. It's something of a relief. But of course, the sorrow does, nothing ever prepares you for sorrow, and nothing ever protects you from it. It's always awful. It's always probably worse than you thought it was going to be.
I ask you because this is such a recurring theme in your fiction, but are there things you were exposed to when you were young that got you thinking about that a lot?
Yeah, my father, who was my beloved parent, died when I was 7. I also have a mother who is a polio victim. And then I grew up with grandparents and another aunt who was a polio victim. So I sort of grew up a half orphan among damaged people. And that seemed to me to be the norm. I'm always surprised at how intact my adult life has been compared to my childhood. I mean, you would think from the way I talk that I go around miserable all the time. And actually, I quite enjoy my life. I mean, I like to laugh. I like to hang out and dance and go to the movies and play with my kids and talk to my friends and eat. There's some instinct in me where, you know, a friend of mine once said, and I agreed with him, I was going to commit suicide today, but then there was this movie I wanted to see. and there is, you know, a great deal of distracting nice things in the world that I do enjoy.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your writing.
Thank you.
Mary Gordon's book of short stories, Temporary Shelter, has just been published in paperback. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
We're following the Iraqi claims that they've been hitting the Iranian capital, Tehran, with surface-to-surface missiles, what those claims might mean if they're true. Also, what the administration has done with respect to Panama's drug-fighting efforts. Today, they declined to certify that Panama is doing all it can to fight the drug traffic. And also, Mrs. Mueller, the East German ice skating coach, who turns out all those brilliant East German ice skating champions?
Are you having her on?
No, we're not. We're having the Mrs. Muellers of Texas beauty pageants on tonight, who turn out just as many Texas beauty champions as the East Germans do ice skaters.
Okay, those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For nearly 25 years, Jonathan Kozol has been writing books and articles about the have-nots in our society, the poor, the illiterate. His books have stirred consciences and fostered debates. Kozol's new book, Rachel and Her Children, is about the homeless. Critic John Leonard has this review.
What is bewildering is not Jonathan Kozol's book. It is a heartbreaking account of the homeless in America and everything we haven't done to help them. What's bewildering is the critical response to Kozol's account. In the New York Times, Time Magazine, The New Republic, and elsewhere, reviewers have wished for some other, better, as yet unwritten book. They've accused Kozol of preaching to the converted, among whom they apparently count themselves, although I've not seen any of them volunteering for overnight duty at a shelter or a church. They've complained about his tone, his ham-handedness, his self-righteousness and bitterness, as if he should have made more art out of the shame of our cities. This puerile aestheticizing of the dreadful is at the very least avoidance behavior and bad faith on the part of the critics, but it verges on something worse. It verges on complicity. If only Zola, writing about the Dreyfus case, had done so with the flair of Flaubert, if only Harriet Beecher Stowe had written as well about slavery as Hawthorne wrote about ghosts or Emerson about trees, then maybe we'd be charmed into doing something. Kozel alternates chapters of personal reportage with chapters of statistics. In a welfare hotel in Manhattan, we meet Kim, who used to be a teacher, Gwen, who used to be a nurse, Peter, who used to be a carpenter, Holly, who once sold Stouffer's sandwiches, Laura, Winnie, Susan, Dobie, Elizabeth, and, of course, Rachel, the welfare mother, who sold herself for $20 worth of Pampers and bologna. Once Kozel's introduced us, we know for a painful fact these people aren't deranged. Having followed him in the alternating chapters through the Byzantine politics of poverty, we can't say the same of the welfare bureaucracy. Then he explains where to go if we want to help, only to be told by tastemakers to calm down, tone down, stop nagging, be objective. More than 30 years ago, this same Kozel, fresh out of Harvard, wrote the sort of book these critics like, an arty novel full of privileged and precious people, called, believe it or not, Fume of Poppies. Then something real happened to him, and suddenly he was teaching in a Boston ghetto and producing impatient and excoriating books like Death at an Early Age and Illiterate America, and his body was always where his mouth was, and he paid his dues while the rest of us still step over broken bodies in the streets. There are, he tells us, more than 100,000 homeless today in New York City alone, a deindustrialized proletariat, a ragged army of the dispossessed, a supply-side migratory tide of despairing mothers and angry beggars and runaway refugee children and almost catatonic nomads living on garbage they pull out of our neat green hefty bags. In our municipal parks, bored teenagers burn them alive. In our newspapers and magazines, bored critics complain that Kozel's picture isn't pretty enough as literary artifact. Our standards for style in moral indictment are a hell of a lot loftier than our standards of decency in applied political science. For shame.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. He reviewed Jonathan Kozel's latest book, Rachel and Her Children. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with film director Bob Swaim. He's best known for the 1982 film La Balance, a Parisian cop thriller that won the César Award for Best Picture. That's the French equivalent of an Oscar. His new film Masquerade stars Rob Lowe and Meg Tilly. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a CD that captures the passion and bombast of maestro Arturo Toscanini leading a rehearsal of La Traviata. And humorist Alice Kahn will look at the 28-year relationship between Barbie and Ken, America's best-known dolls. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.